We concluded our series, our 12-week series on the Acts of the Apostles, and from what I've heard from you around the hallways in the schools or standing after service with a cup of coffee, it was a success. In fact, some of you wished it were longer. Of course, the rule of Hollywood, of course, or at least the stage, is always leave them wanting more. So it would have been, I think, a bad idea to go with the Martin Lloyd Jones version. He was a great evangelical pastor in the early or the middle of the 20th century. He was notorious for the unending series, 3 years on Paul's letter to the Ephesians, 6 years on Paul's letter to the Romans, and never finished. So I think 12 weeks on Acts is just right, leaving us an opportunity to come back to it, perhaps in the future, or to consider other books in the Bible that would increase our devotion to the Lord our God. But having said it that way, we ought not to forget that the lectionary that the church invites us to read every Sunday of the year brings us to Paul's letters almost every Sunday, with only a few variations from that, whether it be into Peter's lessons. Perhaps occasionally we'll have a what's called a proto-epistle from the Old Testament. So the Sunday next before Advent, we get Jeremiah in place of an epistle. But for the most part, we hear from Paul every Sunday. So I imagine that I and Father Heaton will be thinking about our brief journey through the Acts of the Apostles as we treat those portions of Paul's letters as we go. And as a matter of fact, I want to direct your attention today to our epistle lesson that you find in our pew sheet or in your prayer book, Paul's letter to the Galatians, certainly his most fractious or combative of his letters, but certainly one of his greatest, second perhaps only to his letter to the Romans. But Paul writes to the Galatians, whom he visited, as the Acts of the Apostles tells us in Acts, the 16th chapter. Paul left a successful journey down to Jerusalem for, remember, the Jerusalem Council. I preached that sermon to you on Acts 15, where the apostles say that they understand that God has poured out His Spirit upon the Gentiles, and that the Gentiles should not be required to do anything except to believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, to leave off eating things that were strangled, to the eating of blood, of fornication, and but all other things they are encouraged to do as they have been instructed by the apostles, to live lives of virtue, but certainly not to submit to the rite of circumcision. So Paul leaves that council in the 15th chapter and heads off on his second apostolic missionary trip, this time up through Turkey. His first had been a quick jaunt out to Cyprus and back. Now he's off to Turkey, and it's likely then that he meets and gives the gospel, the message of Jesus's victory in the gospel to the Galatians. Galatia and Phrygia, as it's referred to there in Acts 16. And it's likely, although scholars dispute exactly who the Galatians were, but the majority view is that they were a group of Gauls that had drifted back against the tide and had relocated in Asia Minor or Turkey. And there they had been for about 150 years before Paul arrived in around the year 50 AD, and shared with them the news of Jesus' victory over death, that the Gentiles now were being included in God's family. So Galatia, there in the middle, right smack dab in the middle of the world that we call Turkey now today. And Paul tells them that they should remember what God had done for them, and that in his son Jesus, and that they now had been set free from all of the powers that had long enslaved them. So just the verses before our epistle picked up this morning, Paul says to them, "You are called to freedom, brothers. Only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love be servants of one another." Each one of us, amazingly enough, have been called to freedom. We often are tempted by our own culture to think about Christianity as being some kind of moral slavery. It's the dull drag, the grind of the Christian life, and then all the fun has been driven out. And wouldn't it be great if we were all happy pagans again? But Paul says no, as a matter of fact, that the life that we now have been given in the resurrected King of Israel is all about freedom. That we, once before we were trapped, we were held hostage by the powers of this world, and now we have been made free. But Paul reminds them of the fact that those powers, those gods, are only too ready to have us back. If we want to come back, they won't say no. They would love to have us back and to enslave us yet again. And so Paul concludes this letter of his by warning them. Two times he says, "I've warned you already, but I'm warning you again. Don't go back that way. There's a war going on all around us, and we should be clear whose side we are on." I'm always puzzled when I think back on this moment in my seminary career, when our seminary requirement was is that we served in a parish under a priest's direction the whole time that we were in seminary to develop our own practice as future priests in the church. And of course, they always, the priests directing, always gives you the work that they don't want to do, right? So you have to do the youth group, you have to do the Lenten meditation. And yes, it was my turn to do the Lenten meditation. And so I, after a church service and coffee, we sat down in the parish hall and I gave a meditation on spiritual warfare, which I thought was appropriate based on the epistle that had been appointed for the service that day. And a young college student, she wasn't a member of the seminary community, she was a part of the student body of one of the local colleges, hung back after the meditation and said that she thought that that was the worst thing that she'd ever heard in her life. That she was sure that the world was all at peace and that I was just being terribly pessimistic and that really the Christian life was all about being nice to one another. And of course, that makes perfect sense. If you know Episcopalians, and I include us in that, the highest of all the virtues, sadly Aquinas did not know this, he didn't include it in his list of virtues, but the highest of all Episcopal virtues is niceness, followed shortly by good etiquette. So knowing which fork to use, and Ms. Sorensen, I'm a big believer in right fork usage. I don't want to give you the wrong idea. I have my mother's copy of Emily Post's Etiquette on my shelf. I'm a firm believer. But nonetheless, niceness and etiquette don't ever make the list of Christian virtues. We just heard a run-through of Paul's list, and while I'm sure that he wanted the Galatians to be nice to one another, that wasn't really the point that he was trying to drive home. The point that he wanted them to know about was the fact that they were in the middle of a conflict. The desires of the Spirit are at war with the desires of our flesh. For he writes, "The desires of the flesh are against the Spirit, and the desires of the Spirit against the flesh. For these are opposed to each other to keep you from doing the things that you want to do." Now let's be clear. When he's talking about the desires of the flesh, he's not talking about your skin or your muscles. Ladies, if you are anything like my beautiful wife, she has lots and lots of healthcare products. Paul is not talking about taking care of your skin. He's not talking about having lots of good conditioner or an oil treatment for your hair. Okay, the war between the flesh and the spirit doesn't have anything to do with your physical body. What he's using this word, as Father Heaton knows only too well, sarx, doesn't have to do really so much with your skin, so much as it is with what your natural desires are as a human being. The things that make us really feel like we are in the hunt, whether it be for money or for power or for sex or for influence, these are the desires of the flesh. To be the most popular girl in school, to be the strongest guy on the sports field. These are the desires of the flesh that Paul is warning against. But the desires of the Spirit are not simply that we want to go to heaven when we die. That's not the desire of the Spirit either. The desire of the Spirit that Paul is talking about is to be inspired by, to be inhabited by God, to do what He wants us to do. And you know only too well how those two particular demands on our lives are constantly in conflict. One of the great doctors of the church, St. Augustine of Hippo, wrote the work City of God, and he writes this way, "This is the reason why, for all the difference of the many and very great nations throughout the world in religion and morals, language, weapons, and dress, there exists no more than two kinds of society, which, according to our scriptures, we have rightly called the two cities. One city is that of men who live according to the flesh. The other is of men who live according to the Spirit. Each of them chooses its own kind of peace. And when they attain what they desire, each lives in the peace of its own choosing." The city of the flesh achieves its peace by domination, by violence, by war. The city of the Spirit achieves its desires through love of God and love of our neighbor. And so you see then that we are in the midst of this great and cosmic battle. Now, as an aside, I would like to mention that if you, with that lovely young lady up in Wisconsin, if you think that we should not have any conflict at all, I would ask you to check your way of life. If you don't perceive any conflict in your conscience between what you want to do and what you ought to do, then that means that you've already waved the white flag and you have taken the world's part. But you have left the side of Jesus and you have gone to the world. Peace, of course, with the world means that you are no longer the child of God. So if you sit in your chair and say, "I got no problem," well, you do. It's just not the one that you were thinking of. If you don't have a problem with this world, you have a problem with God. So, Paul, to the Galatians, tells them exactly what he wants them to know here. That we are called to freedom, brothers. Only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love, serving one another. For the whole law is fulfilled in one word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. But if you bite and devour one another, watch out that you are not consumed by one another. We always get what we want. So said Aristotle. Not Paul. But Aristotle said that every human act seeks to achieve its own good. We always want to eat ice cream. We never want to eat Brussels sprout. Well, I like Brussels sprout, but you get the point, right? If presented with a hot fudge sundae and green beans, look out, stomach, here comes the hot fudge sundae. We always choose the thing that we want. Our desires drive our decisions. Paul says, as a matter of fact, that they have now been changed. They have been given God's Spirit. And if God's Spirit rules in them, then their desires have changed. You see, desire to serve one another. The natural desire is to bite and devour our neighbor. But Paul says, don't do that, but instead serve them. because if you bite and devour your neighbor, there's going to be a larger neighbor that's ready to bite and devour you too. If we seek to fulfill our own desires as our own end, we find that we will end ourselves in destruction. And so Paul gives us this terrible laundry list of things that human beings end up falling into because of the fact that we do what we want. Sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, which is hatred, and strife, and jealousy, and fits of anger. We can see ourselves in these things in our worst days. They are characteristics of people who seek to get what they want at no cost to themselves and the cost of their neighbors. Hating people, fighting with people, dividing your community up into groups that are in conflict with one another, staying drunk all the time. These are self-destructive. Isn't that odd that when we get what we want, we end up destroying ourselves? But we have been made free, Paul says. Our freedom isn't simply that we get to go to heaven when we die. Our freedom is that we're no longer being gobbled up by others and gobbling ourselves up with our own desires. Seeking to obey God above all things and loving our neighbor as a result ends not in losing ourselves, but in building community. When you stop attacking your neighbor, you actually have an opportunity to be friends with them. I know that this is really basic stuff, but Paul is writing a whole letter to explain to these pagans how it is that the gospel builds community. There is no Western civilization without Christianity. There is no hope for law-abidingness and peace in the world without Christianity. If we are committed to getting everything we want at our neighbor's expense, you can bank on the rest of your life being all about war and bloodshed. But if you are willing to serve someone else beside yourself, dare I say, God and His Son Jesus, then you have hope not only of peace, but also of community. You can actually be a neighbor to someone else. We can actually be a nation. The fruit of the Spirit, you see, is love and joy and peace and patience and kindness, goodness, faithfulness. Characteristics of a neighborhood that you'd like to live in, that you wouldn't mind sinking a couple hundred thousand dollars to buy a house in that neighborhood. Right? Why? Because you're not worried that somebody's going to break in your house every time you turn around and steal your TV. A neighborhood that is marked by people who are caring for you like they care for themselves, that's exactly the world that we would like to live in. And that's the world that Paul says comes to us when we believe in Jesus and we serve Him instead of ourselves. In conclusion, I would like to take a bit of an aside, but not too far, just to remark upon the fact that in our gospel lessons, in 2 weeks in a row, the Samaritan comes to the rescue. Last Sunday, we had the story about the Good Samaritan who saved the man who'd been beaten within an inch of his life, takes him to the hotel, buys him some medical care, and then promises to cover all his bills if there are any more. And today we hear about the fact that of the 10 lepers that were healed, only one of them came back to say thank you, and it was the Samaritan, the outsider, as Jesus says, this alien or foreigner. Notice how it is that the church wants us to hear about how it is that these moments of joy, these moments of kingdom building here on earth happen when the most unlikely folk, not the Jews, but the Samaritans, hear the gospel. Paul going out into Turkey and telling them about Jesus, these ones who believe the gospel, they are the ones who now find that their lives are sprouting full of spiritual gifts like the faith and the hope and the charity that we ask God to give us in our collect today. Living in the Spirit, acting like a Christian, is all about seeking to serve the other. For if we do not, then of course we are still trapped in the powers of darkness. So, my friends, we're given the opportunity here in just a moment to give thanks. The Eucharist, receiving Jesus' own body and blood, is all about that giving of thanks, of thanking God for His giving to us everything we could ever hope for, and in doing so, making us His missionaries into this world. Amen.